welcome to Shattered Lives, a lively, educational, and issues-driven radio show designed to tell another side of the story, to focus on and humanize crime victims, to enlighten and shine the spotlight on organizations and service providers, and to assist those who walk the path with us. This is Donna R. Gore, a.k.a. Lady Justice, your host this evening, and I'm joined by my co-host, Delilah Jones, president of Imagine Publicity. And on tonight's show, we bring you a very special topic. We have as our guest this evening, we're very fortunate to have Dwayne Bowers talking on spirituality and trauma. And I just want to bring Delilah in before we have Dwayne come in. Good evening, Delilah. How are you? It's nice to have you joining me for tonight's show.
Hi, Donna. It's always good to be here every week. And I think, you know, what better time to have Dwayne come back on the show after, you know, this the tragedy in Boston and in Texas, and just on the heels of the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting. We seem to have, as a nation, gone through several very quick, explosive-type tragedies, and it's overwhelming. It's really overwhelming to our body, minds, and spirits. And hopefully Dwayne, and I know he will, have a lot of very good information and a lot of very good tips for people like you and me to get through this. And I'm real anxious to get started with it.
Right. Well, I'm just wondering how we navigate. And Dwayne is no stranger to our show, but just to tell people very briefly, he is a licensed professional counselor from the Washington, D.C. area. And he has worked with many entities, including the Center for Missing and Exploited Children, Team Hope. He also has worked in conjunction with the D.C. office for the Chief Medical Examiner. He's been a consultant for 9/11 and many organizations and conferences. He does training. He's been an adjunct professor with regard to his areas of expertise in post-traumatic stress disorder and suicide, just to name a few things. So, Dwayne, welcome to Shattered Life again, and thank you for helping us navigate this very important topic this evening. It's a pleasure to have you.
Thank you. Hi, Donna. Hi, Delilah. Good to be back, and thank you for having me back.
Well, it's always a treat because we learn so much, and, you know, I hate to think that it's always, as Delilah said, on the heels of a disaster, but we don't have anything to do with that, and we don't have control in the overall sense. But I think our show tonight is about trying to establish control individually, and maybe by harnessing that through our own coping mechanisms and spirituality. And, you know, how do we deal with these successive events of trauma? They just seem to keep happening, even though if we look at it from, you know, a very large sense, it's only a very small microcosm. But since we're talking about spirituality this evening, why don't we start out with the fact that aren't there differences with respect to what spirituality is versus formalized religion, and, you know, the fact that people may choose, do they really choose one or the other, or are they so different?
Well, I think to start, and I think that's a good place to start, is what do we mean by spirituality? Spirituality, from a mental health point of view, actually has probably three different definitions, but the way to that I distinguish it from religion is that religion is just one of the ways that we express our spirituality. Spirituality is a larger one of the definitions is spirituality is my relationship with that which is bigger than me. And whatever you call that, whether it's universe or nature or God or goddess or whatever, your relationship with that thing that's bigger than you is your spirituality. How you express that spirituality is individual, and some folks express it through their religion. Some may express it through communing with nature, being with nature. Some may be so passionate about saving the earth that they express their spirituality through that. Many people actually express their spirituality through volunteering and helping other people. And so there's a lot of ways to express your relationship with that which is bigger. Religion is just one of them. So we're talking about that bigger relationship, how I interact with that bigger thing. And religion is just one way I may express that. Another way of looking at spirituality is what is the meaning and value that I give to my life and to the events that happen in it? And so we look at, you know, what meaning am I giving these things? And that certainly applies to the week we've just been through. What meaning are we going to give that individually? What value are we going to give it in our lives? And if I'm going to give it a meaning that says the world is no longer a safe place and I can't be out in the world anymore, that's a different meaning than someone saying this was an isolated incident and stuff does happen and it's not going to affect the way I interact with the world. So all of those are, you know, spirituality is based on your belief system and what you believe. And so looking at individually how I'm going to allow this to change what I believe about the world is really what each of us is going to go through.
I see. Is it about constantly like readjusting each time as, you know, one of these events tend to happen, or is it a matter of like constantly changing our attitudes from, you know, if we're going through a good period personally and the glass is half full, and then when something like this happens, well, then we tend to be temporarily more pessimistic with respect to overall outlook. You know, are we like one of those little buoys on the ocean that's constantly bobbing up and down? Or is that how we should conduct ourselves and be buoyant with each one of these if we're a healthy person with respect to mental health?
Yeah, and again, I think that's individual, whether we're going to allow the events to change us or not. I think that is individual. Actually, you've kind of pulled us right into something I wanted to talk about, which is the idea of derealization or depersonalization. Many people, when an event happens, they'll say, okay, this event has changed the world. The world is now a different place, and I don't fit in it anymore. And that's what we call derealization. Or a person can say, this event changed me personally, but the world's still the same. But because I've been changed, I don't fit in it anymore. And so some folks can experience that kind of response. Or some folks can, based on their spirituality, say, you know what, this is just something that we will all get through, and I'm not going to allow it to change my view of the world or my view of myself. So, again, I think it depends on the individual, their personal strengths, you know, how they've learned to deal with situations in the past. And, you know, I think we all, I think if you use that ocean metaphor that you used, yes, we can bob around. I think how much we bob is dependent on our spirituality. You know, if we're tied to the bottom, we're not going to bob so much, but we might get splashed every once in a while.
Right.
If we're not anchored to something, we may bob a lot more, but we at least stay afloat. So I like that analogy that you use.
Oh, thank you. When you say that, whether it's derealization or depersonalization, and I don't fit anymore, is the natural outcome to that, is that someone that's contemplating suicide? Or are you, when they say I don't fit, does that mean, oh, I have to change my behavior to fit the world, or I just can't deal with this anymore and give up? Or what is the extension to that statement that you had made earlier?
Well, that's a good question. If I don't fit anymore, then I have some choices. Either I have to adjust so I do fit, or I start to withdraw, and I may have some mental health repercussions to that. I may start experiencing depression or anxiety. I may start, like I said, withdrawing and not interacting with the world so much anymore. Or I could end up having a diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder, where all of those things are present, the withdrawal, the re-experiencing, all of that stuff, but also pulling back from the world and anticipating that something else is going to happen and those kinds of things. So again, I think our spirituality has a lot to do with what that reaction is going to be. And I think we grow in our spirituality with each event, but I think we all start with some level of belief about what the world is and who we are in the world. And so our experience then starts to shape that. And I think one thing I wanted to say was, if you look at what happened in Boston and you look at what happened in Texas, we have two very traumatic situations. And if only one had happened this week, we would be focused on that one. But we had these two very traumatic situations. One was accidental, the explosion in West Texas. It was accidental, but it was more lethal. It killed more people than the situation in Boston. And then you have a situation in Boston which was not accidental. It was intentional. And our reaction to those two things is going to be much different when we know somebody purposely did this, as opposed to this was an accident that just happened. And our spirituality will play in how we respond to those.
Does that mean that the one that was, I'm sorry, Delilah, I just want to ask this quickly. Do you mean that the one that was an accident may not have as long a lasting effect as opposed to the one that was intentional?
It's a much different reaction, because when there is an intentional one, immediately we make a judgment. We immediately say this person's behavior was either right or wrong, and we start taking more of a judgmental role when something was intentional. When it's accidental, well, we also start laying blame and we start putting responsibility somewhere. When it's accidental, it's harder to do that. It's harder to place blame. It's harder to hold something or someone accountable immediately after. And so we tend to rely probably more on our belief system at the beginning when it is accidental. Than we do if it is intentional. We immediately go to our judgment value when we know it's intentional and somebody did it purposefully.
Oh. Delilah?
Oh, I was going to ask Duane to address the fear, something like, you know, what happened in Boston this week. It's a collective fear. And then especially, you know, the way that they went about finding the perpetrator with, you know, armed police and everything out there and basically shutting down a city, going into homes without warrants. This raises the level of fear all across the country to a new level. There again, like you spoke about, when something like this happens, we have to quickly look for someone to hold accountable. Are we reacting too quickly, not quickly enough? And what do we do about the fear, the collective fear?
You know, that's very interesting, Delilah, because my reaction to the way they handled it was not one of fear, but one of, thank God they've got this under control. One of the things that people may not realize is once these two young men allegedly killed the policeman, it was over. In other words, they knew they had nothing to lose. And so the fear then was, they know they have nothing to lose. They know they're probably going to die. The question is, how many are they going to take with them? Are they going to stage a bigger event where they know it's going to take them out, or are they going to set it up for suicide by cop, which is kind of what the older one did. So knowing that, they literally shut down the city so these guys couldn't get out of the city. Because if they'd have gotten out, they could have gone anywhere and just kept this going. So I felt more secure knowing they had shut down the city and they had done it so quickly. And so, again, it has to do, I think, with, you know, how we see the world and how we understand the world and the way things work, as to whether I'm going to be afraid or whether I'm going to respond in a way that says this is positive. You know, we only have two ways of looking at the future. One is fear and one is hope. Those are the only two ways we can look at the future. And we make that choice. So, again, are we as a nation going to become more afraid as a result of this? I don't know. That's yet to be seen. I think we will become more afraid of mass gatherings and that sort of thing, you know, every time an event like this happens. But I think the Boston police, and I give them a lot of credit, and the police in the area, kind of reinstilled people's faith in law enforcement in the way they handled it.
I think when she talked about, my interpretation of her question was with the collective fear, the people in Watertown and the fact that, you know, that city was locked down like you do so in a prison, and not so much with respect to people, you know, across the nation or individually. If I was in that town or they came to my town, they did the same thing, I would think we would feel a collective sense of fear just by based on geography.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, I hear what you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. But that's very, very interesting. You know, fear versus hope for the future. And, you know, I just think we have to take each day as it comes and not be, you know, doomsdayer.
Yeah. Well, I agree with you, Donna. And I think in this day and age with instant news and news that's constant. I mean, it's a constant barrage of what's going on. We see and hear and look at everything in real time, where in the past it wasn't quite that way. We might read it in the newspaper the next morning, but now everything is live. And I don't think that there's a lot of people out there that have the mechanisms to handle that. What do you think, Dwayne?
Yeah. We saw that after 9/11, particularly people unable to literally turn off the TV, and they were becoming overwhelmed with all of the stuff that was coming out. And unfortunately, media now thinks that in these situations they have to be on 24/7, that they have to be constantly saying something and doing something. And so what happens is they start bringing in information or whatever that starts to shape our opinion of what's going on. And I think that tends to be very dangerous, because I think very, very often media can assist in the way people look at whether they're going to be afraid of a situation or whether they're going to have hope that the situation comes to an end. And a lot of times it's about selling. It's about sales. I mean, if you know, the more edgy the information, the more edgy the situation, the more people will watch. And so that's
really
a very
doing?
Good point as far as how is our spirituality affected by what keeps coming in. And I mean, the last 48 hours with nothing but, you know, on the news, you know, CNN and whatever, with nothing but this just coming in. And you had to turn it off. You know, you just had to, because you'd be overwhelmed otherwise. So that's a good point.
Some people, it almost becomes an addiction to, you know, hear it, see it, feel it first. And I don't know that it's a healthy thing. Personally, I haven't watched the news in years. I mean, there's enough, you know, I know people who, you know, they have the television on news stations all the time. Then while they're doing that, they're online and you're getting another dose of it over here. So it's a constant barrage. And personally, I can't handle what I look at, let alone even more. I just, you know, I'm one of those, I'd like to just stick my head under the covers and wait until, you know, the morning comes and everything is peaceful again. It's overwhelming.
There is a basic premise that the more information I have, the more sense of control I have. And I think that does play out. The more information I can get, and this certainly is true of crime victims, the more I know what happened to my loved one, the more I feel I'm in control, if not of the situation, at least of myself and of what's happening now. And so I think one of the reasons people kind of get addicted to watching the news is they get this sense of control. If I know what's going on, then I have more sense of control over what's happening to me in this moment. And
yeah.
I think that they get sucked into it in that way.
I think generational too. Yeah, but like the older generation, maybe they don't have a job to go to, so they're home, and they're I'm thinking of a particular couple of relatives, and they might sit there and watch all, you know, 8-10 hours of it at a clip, whereas I wouldn't. And, you know, Duane, I don't know if this necessarily relates, but it sort of does. You know, our family is facing a parole hearing coming up this next week for the man that murdered my father. And I remember sitting through a 3-week trial, and my mother and myself, and, you know, I wanted to be there as much as possible, I guess, for that sense of control, even the autopsy results. And my relative had to vacate because she couldn't take that, and they questioned, well, how could you do that? And it was my sense of having control intellectually, wanting to understand all of the pieces. On an emotional level, no, I did not want to be there and listen to autopsy results or look at gory pictures or whatnot. But I felt like I had to be there to understand even that piece of the puzzle to try to make sense of this. Does that somehow relate in another way to what we're talking about?
I think so, because when we need to make sense of something, then once we're able to put it back in an order, into take this chaos and turn it back into an order, that is our belief system is what's happening there. Our belief system is what's helping us to do that. And so give me all this information, and I'll try to make it all fit into a place that I can now say, aha, this makes sense. I don't understand it, but I see how all of this happened, and it allows me to accept it better. One thing about trauma is that, and you may find this surprising, but what the information is saying now is the more I believe I had some kind of control over the situation, the less likely it is to be traumatic. So the more I believe that there was no control, the more likely I am to be traumatized. So anything that we can do to give a sense of control to this event, that it makes sense in some way, will help us to not be traumatized to this. And again, I think that is a spiritual response, because mm-hmm. we're trying to get it to fit within our belief system of what is right, what is wrong, what is the world, how do I fit into that world with this new information.
Right. And can we prepare for the next one? Because we know that there will be a next one at some point in time somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Prepare, I'm not sure is a good word. Can we allow ourselves to spiritually incorporate it into our lives better? Yes, I think so. And one of the keys to that is being adaptable, is having a worldview that says, you know what, stuff happens. And sometimes it's intentional, sometimes it's disaster, sometimes it's accidental, but stuff happens. And I'm accepting the fact that there is a world in which things can happen. Those folks are much more likely to be able to
ride the wave.
Yeah, exactly. Than someone, because they're anchored to the idea that stuff is going to happen, as opposed to someone who believes that my world is safe, and as long as I'm good, nothing bad will happen to me, and I'm just going to do what I do. I go to work, I come home, and I'm going to be safe, and then boom, they get held up in a store or whatever, because they don't have a worldview that could incorporate that. It's much harder for them to change their perspective of the world and their place in it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think
yeah.
so. You know, I also am curious, as we've talked in a couple of other shows that you've been on about my favorite term, because you say it applies to me, post-traumatic growth. Now, out of these traumas, and in particular, if we've been somehow personally touched, if, you know, we live in Connecticut, we live in Newtown, we have a relative in Boston that was in that area or whatever, or we do something hands-on, can we experience post-traumatic growth from these kinds of events? Is it likely?
Yes. In fact, it's one of the ways that people recover from the event, and it's also one of the ways that we express our spirituality. And the point of post-traumatic growth is to give a different meaning and a different value to the event. And like you said, I work a lot with the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. So I work a lot with parents whose children have been abducted and missing or abducted and murdered. And how do you give a different meaning? How do you give a different value to that? Well, if you can find a way to help, and one of the ways that that happens is to help others who are in the same situation. You find that if you can help others who are going through the same thing you have been through, this is a form of post-traumatic growth, but it also is a way that we express our spirituality, because what we're saying is, I don't want this incident with my child. I don't want this just to be my child was murdered. I want something positive to come out of this. I want something good to come out of this. I can't control the fact that they were murdered, but I can help others who may be going through the same thing, so they don't have to have it quite as hard as I did, or they don't have to do it alone like I did. This gives it a whole different meaning and a whole different value, because out of this horrible thing, something positive happens, such as this radio show, such as all the work that you have done, Donna. You have taken that situation of your father's murder, and you have made something out of it that has a positive value, that's been able to help other people. And that's post-traumatic growth, and that has come from your spirituality, from your belief about the world and your place in it, and what value you wanted to give. You could have said, my father was murdered and I'm a victim for the rest of my life, or you could say, my father was murdered, I'm mad as hell, and I'm going to do something about it, and I'm going to make a change and make something positive come from this, which is what you did.
Right. Well, thank you, and I totally agree. And, you know, that makes me feel like I'm on the right track in life here. And the other thing that comes to mind is I'm thinking of many of the parents from Newtown that accompanied President Obama back to Washington and tried to sometimes in vain lobby Congress with regard to, you know, background checks and all of that. And they tried their hardest, but ultimately politics won out and they didn't accomplish that. But imagine they are exhibiting their spirituality, and they're bringing it to a different level beyond the children that they lost. And look at how empowered they are now, and they're not giving up either, Duane.
Exactly. And let me take it to a different level. Yes,
sure.
Congress did not vote the way that they had anticipated, and in fact did not vote the way that the country wanted them to vote, because the statistics were showing overwhelmingly that while there was a lot of controversy about gun control itself, overwhelmingly, most people were in favor of background checks. So these politicos who decided not to vote the way their constituency wanted them to, you got to ask, who are you there to serve? But all that aside, what you do want to look at is those numbers changed significantly when those parents started becoming active in the conversation, and when they started going to the Hill, and when they started being in the news saying, you know, I want my son's death, I want my daughter's death to mean something, and this is the value I want it to have. And those numbers changed significantly. The number of people that were in favor of background checks rose significantly after they became visible. So all I'm saying here is they didn't fail. They didn't fail. They did.
Oh, no, I don't think they failed. I think Congress
failed. Right,
we
need to do something different. And, you know, eventually Congress will catch on, whether that means a new bunch in Congress or whatever. But eventually people's will be done.
Like, when you sing again, go ahead. We like to see instant reaction. Again, you know, we're into this instant society now where news is, everything is instant. So, of course, We want to see legislative changes happen now. And we forget that it takes time, and what do we do with that time until something positive is a result of the efforts of people like Donna and like others who have survived things like this? Where do we regain that trust in humanity, especially mm-hmm. when with a situation like Boston, where it was a man-made or man-done situation? So it seems to me like every time something happens like 9/11, like Boston, like Sandy Hook, we tend to lose a little more trust in humanity itself. Mm-hmm. What's your advice, Dwayne? Where can we regrow that trust factor?
When I'm talking to someone who has that issue or who's expressing that, one of the things we have to get it back into perspective. How many marathons have happened this year in the United States, and how many got bombed? How many marathons have there been in the last 3 years, and how many had a bombing incident involved? Mm-hmm. Helping a person to kind of come back and say, okay, yes, it did happen, but it's one out of thousands. And this one, it got a lot of press. We were all aware of it, but there are many other marathons going on that this has never happened to, and so I don't have to start fearing every marathon. I think people get, because of the media, again, people get caught up into a single image and forget that it's happening in a larger perspective. There's a larger worldview out here, and that this is one incident out of many, and this incident was bad. But look at Sandy Hook, and I'm not in any way minimizing the deaths or the loss of life or whatever, but saying how many elementary schools are there in the country and how many has someone gone in and killed 26 kids. There, you have to balance personally, be able to balance the perspective to be able to step forward, to move forward. And then the other thing that helps you to do that is if you're really passionate about this, then get involved in what's necessary to help change it, whatever that may be. Get in your neighborhood watch group. Become an auxiliary police officer if you want. If you want to make a change, if you want to be part of
something.
Making it safe again, and this becomes that post-traumatic growth again, and that becomes what is your worldview and what is your place in this. You can choose to sit back and say, I'm a victim of this and I have no control, or you can choose to say, I need to do something that makes me feel like I'm at least part of the solution, not part of the problem. And helping folks find that, and that can be as simple as donating money to something, or somebody told me the other day, you know what I'm going to do as a result of this? I'm going to get a dog, and I'm going to have it trained as a visiting dog, because there was a little thing on the news about they had taken visiting dogs into the survivors of the bombing. And so that's how that person is going to feel that they're making a difference, and how they're going to feel that something good came out of this. You see what I'm saying?
Right. Yeah. You find a piece that is meaningful for you. And what is that cliche that you just said? Because I was just thinking of that as you were speaking. If you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem. Should we all, as American citizens, take responsibility in doing something proactive when this happens? I mean, there are many people that just get up, go to work, come home, and, you know, have their family, and they don't care about what's going out in the outside world until something happens. But should we be accountable for taking some responsibility to change something, to make something better in our world? And does that help decrease the paranoia?
I'm going to disagree.
Okay.
I don't think everyone has to respond to these kinds of things in an active way, unless it's going to benefit them in some way. Some people, what they are passionate about is their family. and their family becoming the best it can be. So where they're going to put their energies into making the world a better place is in how they raise their kids and how they provide for their kids and how they provide a safe environment for their kids. Some folks may be really into the planet and saving the planet and making it, help it to survive and making it a safe place. So, you know, I may not
be... contribution. Yeah.
Yes. But what I'm saying is when a big disaster like this occurs, I don't think everyone should have the need to do something about that. Everybody is kind of drawn to their own thing, but whatever their thing is, yes, they should be a part of the solution, not part of the problem. I agree with that. But it may not be I'm going to do something about what happened in Boston. My interest is more in maybe helping the homeless or whatever. So all I'm saying is I think we all have something we're passionate about that we want to put our time and energy into and making the world better because of it. And, yeah, the more we do that, the happier we will be, and actually the more spiritual we are becoming and the better able we would be to handle some situation if it were to occur, because we're already helping to make things better. We're already being proactive.
Yeah, and I was thinking of that in the global sense. Not that everybody has to, you know, send a $100 check to people in Boston, but, you know, do something to make it, to make the world a better place. And if you think back, this may have been the impetus for you to start doing that, whatever contribution it was, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, yeah, that's true. And with respect to, I was thinking along the lines of these events being a continuum, Duane. And at one end, and tell me if I'm correct, one end there's complacency. And after this passes, well, you know, that happened over there and it's not going to happen here. This is a quiet little town. Or the other end of it is super, is hypervigilance and, you know, making sure that you you can never go to the park until you have a thorough search of everything or whatever. How do we how do we balance that? And, you know, are there those people at both ends of the spectrum, or are most people in the middle? And, you know, if we're at both ends of the spectrum, who wins? If people do that, if they're totally complacent after 9/11. Or they're so hypervigilant they can't function.
Right. I think you do have that. I think if you look at a bell curve, you probably is your best example of, you will always have people on the extremes. You will always have people who, for one reason or another, can't cope in a healthy way. But for the most part, I think most of us fall kind of in the middle where we are empathetic. We connect to what's happening. We may be driven to do something to help support in some way, or at least be a little more vigilant about watching around. You know, looking for. I live in D.C., so constantly in the subways, constantly when you're driving down the road, you get those digital signs that say, if you see something unusual, call Homeland Security. Constantly in the subways, we'd say, if you see a package, report it to somebody, you know. So it's about maybe being a little more vigilant, but not being hyper-vigilant. Maybe detaching a little bit and saying, okay, that happened in Boston, it didn't happen here, but what do we need to do here to make my, what do I need to think about to make my family a little bit safer? So I think most of us fall in the middle. Now, those that are on the extremes, guess where they end up? In my office. They end up usually needing some kind of support, whether it's mental health, whether it's their pastor, whether it's some kind of support to help them deal with. Or they may start doing some self-destructive behaviors, particularly people who are hyper-vigilant, to calm themselves down, maybe start drinking, start overeating, start whatever, to make themselves feel better. Same with the complacency. Well, to make myself feel better, I'll just, you know. Comfort food has that name for a reason. It makes me feel better.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. It makes me feel better. And that's what junk food has done for us for years. Well, yeah, you can overeat, you can use drugs, you can use alcohol. There's a lot of self-destructive ways to deal with those people on the ways that people on the fringes deal too.
People on the fringes,
But if we get back to this sense of spirituality and look at, okay, what meaning and value are you giving this? remember that our spirituality comes from us. We create it, and we create the meaning that we give things, and we create the value that we give things. So if I'm going to let this take over my life so I'll never go out my door again, that's the value I'm giving it. I'm creating that. And so this is where they may need some support. They may need some mental health support. Here's another thing people can do. As a result of Boston, is they can keep their eye on their neighbors and see which of their neighbors maybe aren't coping so well and maybe do need somebody to talk to or need somebody to kind of give them a little assistance to get to somebody they need to talk to. You can do things even on that level to just kind of watch out for your neighbor and see how this has affected each other. And that's post-traumatic growth, you know?
Mm-hmm. That is true. Do you get the sense that overall, with these series of events, with Colorado and Columbine, I mean, starting, a few years ago up until the present, that people may be flocking to or alternately abandoning formalized religion as a consequence of these series of mass murders? Or do you find that, there's a big increase in people, joining a church or doing something spiritual? I don't know how that exactly works. Are there any studies that talk about that?
I have not seen any. That doesn't mean they're not out there, but as far as trauma material and that sort of thing, I haven't seen any studies about churches getting more members. But again, that's not spirituality, remember.
Right.
That's one way of expressing spirituality. You know, one of the things, when it comes to an idea of God that comes up when I experience a trauma, is what is it that I expect of my God? And if my God fails me, I'm much more likely to turn away from my religion and find my spirituality somewhere else. As opposed to if my God supports me. And it depends on what do you expect from your God. And I'm using that term. It can be Allah, it can be Goddess, whatever your belief is. But if And the difference comes here. If I believe that I can ask my higher power for something, and I believe that it should give it to me, and it doesn't, then it has failed me. And so my expectation has not been met, and I get weak in my faith, I get weak in my spirituality. But if I believe that my higher power's purpose is to help me get through everything that comes along in life, I'm much more likely to stay connected with my higher power. And I got to tell you, as I work with parents of missing children, this is what I see over and over again. Those who believe that God's role is to help give me the strength to get through this usually get even stronger in their connection with their God and their higher power and their religion. Folks who think that I'm going to pray to God to protect my kid and bring him home, and when my kid ends up getting murdered, then God failed me, and they're the ones that tend to turn against their belief system or their religion. So the point of that is to say, I don't know that we're moving more and more toward church as a result of this, but I think we are looking at what is it are we expecting from this thing we call God or this thing that we have this relationship with. Do we expect this thing to give us everything we ask for, or do we expect this just to give us the strength to get through day by day by day? And that's going to be a big difference.
Well, it sounds to me like, we should look at it in terms of being more open-ended and, gauge our it's not like a black or white or, result in terms of, I want this result. I need to pass this test. I need to, whatever it is, a finite thing versus, help me get through this event, to me sounds like a much more realistic, humanistic kind of outreach or request for help, and that, and a much more healthy way of looking at our higher power, whatever that may be. So I think you make an excellent point there that I hadn't thought of, because when we have a person murdered in our family, we immediately say, well, our higher power has failed us, but yet look at what we've survived and look at what we've overcome. So we have not failed in the broad sense. We've become stronger. My family has started a new life after a new normal, whatever that may be. So we have not failed in that true sense. I think that's an excellent perspective, Duane.
In answer to your question, then, I think maybe what's happening is maybe as a result of these things, we're moving away from the idea that God gives us everything we ask for, and we're moving more toward God is a God or higher power is a thing that helps us get through these kinds of events. And the more I think we turn to a higher power that helps us to get through and gives us strength to get through what comes, probably the more resilient we become as a people.
Yeah, that's certainly true.
Don't you think, too, Duane, that we have to come to the realization that these types of situations have happened since time began, since human beings were on Earth. It's not something new. Although it may seem new to us or new to our generation or new to our country and new to our neighborhood, it's not. And somehow
or
another...
Wow, that's common sense. Yeah.
Yes. There's a lot
but
of...
But here's what is new. We in the past have read... Oh, I'm sorry. Delilah, I missed the last part of you.
I've seen a lot of common sense go out the window, especially when these things happen. People tend to come out of the woodwork with comments and opinions that are just totally off the wall, and they're just not healthy. And
yeah.
What do you do with all of that? There again.
I think it was you that had brought this up. The big difference now is that we see it as it happens, and in some cases we almost think the media is creating the news because they're right there when it happens, as opposed to in the past when we read about it after the fact. And what are we seeing? We don't just see the news. We see people giving their impressions of the news. We see Wolf, what's his name, and we see Nancy Grace, and we see these people who give us how to think about the news. And, you know, we didn't have that so much anymore. We had the Cronkites and we had the Rathers and whoever that just said, this is what happened and here it is. And now we have many shows, particularly on cable, that put value on what has happened and make it good or bad and kind of try to tell us how we should think about this. And so I think you do get a different reaction from a lot of people, especially people who maybe are they're not ready to deal with this kind of stuff. They're much maybe more vulnerable to listen to another person's opinion. And, you know, in the past, I mean, we have churches who are threatening to demonstrate at the funerals of the victims of Boston for some unrelated political reason. If that was to have happened in the past, it wouldn't have been included in the news. We wouldn't have heard about it. They would have been considered, you know, fringe folk that had nothing to do really with the story. And now they get almost as much press as the event itself. So you're right. I think people have to make a determination as to let's go back to this idea of what is my worldview and how do these odd elements fit into it? How does this person's opinion fit into my worldview? How does what they're doing in response to the bombing fit into my worldview? And how much value am I going to give what they have to say? And so I think maybe now we have many more things that we have
examples
to
choose from.
We have to be discriminating in terms
of being smarter than that talking head there on the news. I mean, we really do. And I'm wondering, do you find that maybe 30 and above and 30 and below, there's generational differences in general in terms of the perspective and how these things are looked at just because of the younger generation and what they've been brought up with and, you know, versus, you know, older people like us?
I don't, and I'll tell you why. I'll use this as an example. my parents are you know, older generation, and compared to my generation, more conservative. And who are they drawn to? I would never have believed, but my parents, when they go to bed, they listen to radio, and they listen to some of the most conservative radio stations and radio commentators that you could believe exist. Mm-hmm. And it surprises me because I always thought they were a little more open to a wider viewpoint. I don't think so. I think you kind of are drawn to what you're comfortable with. And and again, that's based on your worldview, and it's based on your belief system, and it's based on your spirituality. What meaning and value are you giving your life and the events in it? And when you hear someone that says something that makes you comfortable, you're going to be drawn to that, I think. So I don't think it is generational.
Okay, well, that's good. We keep coming back to that, and it's individual. Is spirituality throughout one person's life, like, constantly changing, like, fluid? And, you know, so, like, what I thought when I was 20 is very different than what I think now in my 50s, or the things, I mean, sure, our interests change with our experiences and our education and who we interact with, but is it the same with spirituality?
I believe it is. Now, most of what I've said up to this point, I could back up with research and whatever. This is going to come a little more from my personal opinion, but yeah, I think if you are an active participant in life, yes, your view of the world has to change. Yes, the value that you give certain things. Well, look, some of the things that may have been so important in a relationship, if you've been married a long time, my husband looking at another woman when we were first married, that would have caused a big fight. Now if he wants to look at other women, let him. You know, my values change. The value I give things, the meaning I give things changes. I think that's true. However, I do think you have a sect of people and a part of the population that is taught something at childhood and will hold on to that belief system throughout their life. So they tend not to change, and they tend not to grow through that. And I'm not saying that's right or wrong, but I think they're in the minority where they don't allow life to let them question their beliefs. They don't allow life experiences to modify what they believe about the world, about God, about a higher power. They hold on to that regardless of what happens. I think what happens in that case is it's harder for them to accept these experiences because a rigid point of view, and I said that before, the more adaptable I am in my thinking, the more resilient I am. If I have a rigid worldview, it's going to be really hard to get through some of this stuff.
Right. And to me, that sounds like some very conservative, maybe organized religion type of situations where, you know, they hang on to that for dear life, and they can't be open-minded with regard to other things in life. And that's their, that gives them their balance in life, or it's their yardstick for everything, and they can't change, or they don't feel comfortable doing that. So,
and it's very difficult for them to change, and I think it's very difficult for them. And I'm not saying this is right or wrong. I'm just saying I think their experience of these kinds of events is much different than perhaps mine, because I'm a little more fluid. I allow my belief system to change as the world changes, and to hold on to something really tight. You got to give them credit for being able to do that, but I think it makes it hard for them to accept these situations as they occur in our experience.
Yeah, I kind of harken back to, you know, with each one of these, you become, or at least I become temporarily very disillusioned with, you know, just very disappointed that this could occur again. But then you try to be buoyant and you talk about the hope for the future. So, again, I think, like you say, it's very individual.
And I want to bring it back to that point that you just made, and that is, again, we have two ways of looking at the future, and this is the root of our spirituality. How are you going to look at the future? What value are you going to give the future? Are you allowing this event to make you see the future with fear or with hope? And that's going to come from your spirituality. That's going to come from your belief about the world and your place in it. That's going to come from the value you give your life and your experiences.
Yeah.
And so, absolutely, how you look at the future is going to dictate how how you interact with the things that happen as they come. Absolutely.
Yeah, well, you know, you've given me a shot in the arm, because sometimes you think, am I the only one that thinks this way? But it's very nice to be validated that, you know, with the ebb and flow of life, and sometimes the, you know, the ebb of, or the negative just seems to overtake the positive, and it's harder to bounce back up sometimes, but you still have to keep doing it. I want to
quote something that I saw on Facebook, and they posted this over and over and over again. It's Mr. Rogers and Fred Rogers. His quote, that whenever bad things happen, my mother always used to tell me, look for the people who are running to the event to help.
Mm-hmm.
And the point of that is, yeah, you can look at what horrible things have happened, but there's always something you can look at in the event to find something good. And even if that's who were the people who were running to help.
That silver lining in the cloud, right?
Mm-hmm. And it's a matter of which do you choose to see, and that's based on your worldview and the value you give things.
Oh yeah, I think that's an excellent metaphor. That truly is. I know our time, we don't have too much more time here, but I wanted to ask, this is kind of a different question. With all of these events that we have had, it seems that they're public events. Granted, Sandy Hook was contained in a school, but how do people who deal with these types of events, whether it be law enforcement, people that do what you do for a living, crowd control, and what should be the watchword here in terms of trying to manage events in that fine line between letting the event happen and, you know, not being a military state kind of thing?
That's a good question. I'm not sure that relates really to spirituality, but, you know, somebody said to me the other day, you know, there's somebody from the Midwest, and they said, we're really not impacted by these things so much where I am. And I said, really? When's the last time you got on a plane? Did you have to half undress to get onto that plane? Did you have to step into a machine that could reveal everything about you to get on that plane? You have been affected. And I think what happens is compare our life today to 20 years ago. We're already in what could be considered a military state, because we can't even get on a plane without somebody looking at our personal parts, you know?
Right. That's true.
In some ways, we've already moved so much in that direction, and probably will continue to. I mean, look, we had a White House that cars used to drive by, and now you can't get a car within, you know, 50 meters of the White House. I mean, we had an open Capitol. Now it's not so open. We have already, and we are in a process of continuing to move toward that. So it's how much will people tolerate, I think, is how much of a military state will we become. When people finally said, you know what, I don't want you looking at my private parts, finally they started using a different machine. When people started saying, no, you can't touch me there, then they had to start changing the way TSA did things. So I think we're in control of how military we become, and we are going to allow it as far as we feel safe. If we believe that what you are doing is helping me to be safe, I will allow you to do it. If I think you're overstepping your bounds, I will start calling you on it. I mean, they used to pat down infants. They don't do that anymore, you know?
Okay.
So,
wow.
If you're 80 years old, you don't have to take off your shoes anymore, because, you know, how hard is it for an 80-year-old to take off and put on their shoes? It's absurd, you know? So anyhow, all I'm saying is, We will dictate that based on our sense of security. If we feel what you're doing is making me feel secure, we'll let you do it. But if we think it's getting a little over the line, no, we're going to call you on it.
Yeah, that's true. Well, and if you had in one sentence some last-minute advice with regard to our spirituality, what would it be?
allow yourself a sense of future that provides for hope and provides for lots of possibilities, but you will stay strong no matter what happens. That's basically it.
All right. Well, that kind of says it all in one sentence. And I just want to say thank you so much, Dwayne. It's been a very informative hour, as always. And please do look. We will have a blog tomorrow, and this show will be on our archives. And we will for sure invite you again because you're a wealth of information. Thank you so much. Have a good rest of the weekend. Delilah, thank you so much. And everyone, please do tune in to Shattered Lives next Saturday for another interesting show. And be safe. Good night.